I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Abigail Fisher says the University of Texas at Austin discriminated against her when it denied her admission in 2008. She is white and contends the university's admissions policy, which considers race in a percentage of its applicants, favors Latinos and African Americans over students like her. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear her case tomorrow, almost a decade after it heard a previous case involving affirmative action. Their ruling will have implications for colleges, universities, students, and applicants across the country. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. We begin with Ben Weider. He covers education for Stateline. That's a news service of the Pew Center on the States. He's written previously for the Chronicle of Higher Education, Newsday, and the Center for Public Integrity. And Ben Weider, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Why is this such an important case?
Well, it really gets at a question of how important diversity is in higher education, and that has implications for, you know, the next generation of leaders in our country.
Leaders, how so? Maybe because leaders tend to come out of colleges and universities?
Typically, yes. I mean, I think that some of the concerns that people have if affirmative action were to go away, particularly at some of the top universities in the country, is that our next class of leaders would be less diverse. Think about the presidential election. You have one candidate who graduated from Harvard Law School versus another candidate who graduated from Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School. There's definitely a sense that top universities prepare our nation's leaders.
Let me go with something going back to the 2003 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Essentially, the court or the justices reaffirming the view that, quote, student body diversity is a compelling state interest that can justify the use of race in university admissions. Is that being then challenged by the supporters in this case?
The idea that racial diversity is important is not necessarily being challenged. The idea that what's being challenged is how you achieve that and whether you can give an advantage to one student over another in the hopes of achieving diversity in an educational setting. The idea is that some states have been able to achieve a level of diversity in their universities by using various other measures that don't necessarily take race explicitly into account.
What do we know about Abigail Fisher? There was a piece about her today in the New York Times, but I know she's been, she hasn't been out there promoting her case. What do we know about her?
We know that she just graduated from LSU recently. She's living in Austin. And we know that when she applied to the University of Texas in 2008, she didn't quite make the cutoff for the university's automatic admissions program. They have a program. It was originally designed to give automatic admission to any Texas graduate who finished in the top 10% of his or her high school class academically. She didn't make that mark, and so she applied for a smaller pool of spots in the freshman class, which are decided on a holistic basis based on other factors, including academics, but also various personal characteristics.
What would be included in those personal characteristics?
Well, race would be one. Socioeconomic factors could be another, but other things could be included. You know, musical talent. If you were a student body president, that could be something that counted in your favor. Basically, they have a very mechanical approach for the majority of the class, that 10%. And then with this smaller portion of the class, they look at it as a way to sort of fill in some of the gaps and make sure that that class is diverse on a variety of levels. I mean, they want to have leaders and great musicians in addition to ethnic diversity.
And looking at, this is University of Texas, but looking at that top 10%, it might be now down to 8%, but nonetheless, taking the top academic performers, essentially accepting them all into the University of Texas, has that created a diverse college campus setting?
The numbers definitely have improved if you look at it overall. Texas is an interesting case because they, for several years, had their racial characteristics knocked out of their admissions policy because of a previous ruling at the district level. And in that time period, they were actually able to boost their diversity over the previous period. So basically, they had several years where they were not allowed to use race in admissions. And during that time, they were actually able to create a more diverse freshman class than when they had previously been using race. So at Texas now, their diversity levels are much higher than they've ever been before. With that said, the state of Texas has gotten more diverse over time. 38% of the state is now Hispanic, according to the census. 12% of the state is African American. The numbers at University of Texas aren't close to that.
But I'm thinking about this top or 8 or 10%. So if for instance, it were a largely African American school, one could assume that that top 8 or 10% would be largely African American.
That's true, and that's exactly how it's worked out. The top 10% rule contributes to the majority of that diversity. And the state argues that while on the surface that's a good thing, there are some problems with that. Because to some extent it relies on a segregated K-12 school system for that to work. You have to have majority African American high schools. You have to have majority Hispanic high schools to get that level of diversity. And so it raises the question of whether that's something that we ultimately want.
Well, and that gets then to this holistic admissions policy based on these various other criteria.
Right, right. And, you know, like I said, they see it as filling gaps. And within, you know, within their target, their goal of diversity, ethnic diversity, they see it as this is a way to get students who aren't necessarily coming from those majority Black or Hispanic high schools who might be coming from a more integrated high school. In some cases, they might be wealthier students, and they argue that that's actually important because it creates more diversity within those ethnic groups. So you don't have just Black students who went to majority Black high schools. You also have Black students who went to high schools that were very mixed.
I'm quoting something from the University of Texas President William Powers, and he said basically the only goal to create a university environment is where students are learning and drawing from and sharing their experiences with people from different backgrounds, and that's diversity writ large, geographic diversity, intellectual diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity. Going back to this case, though, before the U.S. Supreme Court, and even going back to Abigail Fisher, now she wasn't in that top 10%, she's really challenging this holistic view of admissions?
What she's challenging is the use of race in this holistic view of admissions. She feels as though race is one of several factors that's part of a personal index that's attached to students. She feels as though by virtue of her race not giving her an advantage, she was at a disadvantage. She would say she doesn't have a problem with holistic admissions necessarily, but she doesn't think race should be a part of it.
Now, this court, obviously, if it's made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, there have been some lower court decisions on this particular case. What have those lower courts ruled?
The lower courts have supported the University of Texas. They've accepted that, you know, there is a valid educational goal to achieve diversity, and that because this is just one of several factors and it's not the decisive factor, you know, a candidate's ethnic background, that it's acceptable.
Is there any way for a student, whether it's Abigail Fisher or any other student, to know the exact criteria why they were selected or they were rejected at a university?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are scores involved here. The way they describe it is they kind of create a score based on your academic record and your personal record, and then they kind of, once they've assigned you that score, they set a cutoff and say all the scores above a certain level make the cutoff, all the scores below don't make that cutoff. Now, I don't know that that is made public, and in the University of Texas filing, they get into some of her background and how she compared based on the numbers to the rest of the class, but they don't get into what her overall score was.
Again, I'm quoting from some reporting here that based on her score and also the University of Texas decision, some minority students with lesser or equal scores to Fisher's were admitted, but then so were other white students. Does that complicate the case at all?
It does complicate the case. I mean, what we're thinking about here when we think about diversity within these indexes that the university uses is that, for example, someone who is, you know, first chair in the state's youth orchestra might be given a boost even though they have lower test scores and lower academic grades. So there's so many factors involved. It's hard to pinpoint one specific factor that led to her getting in or not getting in, and that's the argument the university makes. There's so many factors. I mean, the term they use is that it's a factor of a factor. There's so many variables at play that it's hard to pinpoint one specific factor that was responsible for her getting in or not getting in.
Now, this is a very different court from the court that ruled in 2003, including the fact that Sandra Day O'Connor is no longer on the court. Samuel Alito, in a sense, is sitting in her chair. And I know it's not easy or probably even wise to predict what the Supreme Court may or may not rule. But how do you see this playing before the court?
Well, the sense I get from talking with experts on the court and with legal scholars is, you know, the court has definitely taken a more conservative shift since 2003. That's I don't think that's in dispute. And in this case, in particular, one of the justices who's normally thought of as being one of the more liberal justices, Elena Kagan, has actually recused herself from this case. So it's a harder road to make for the liberal part of the court if they're hoping to uphold Grutter and uphold the Texas plan in its entirety.
But that leaves it in Justice Kennedy's lap.
Basically, that's the sense most people have, that the Justice Kennedy, as is often the case, is the swing vote in this case. If he were to go along with the typically more conservative wing of the court, you could see a decision that would be 5-3. If he were to join forces with the more liberal part of the court, you could see a split decision maybe that was 4-4.
And what does that mean, a split decision?
A split decision would essentially be a victory for the University of Texas in that it would uphold the previous rulings. So the previous rulings that have upheld the Texas plan would be what ultimately was the decision.
And who have presented amicus briefs on both sides? How are the sides lining up on this particular case?
Oh, well, certainly on the University of Texas side, you have a pretty broad coalition. You have many, many universities, both public and private. A number of states have filed briefs supporting the University of Texas and the U.S. government, in addition to the business community. On the other side, you have people who are arguing that, that college admissions should be based on merit alone. You have various legal groups that have been opposed to affirmative action throughout its history, essentially.
It's an interesting coalition. You've got universities, some states, U.S. government, and members of the business community. That's an unusual coalition on the same side.
Their argument is essentially that, to best prepare leaders and, workers for the next generation, they need to be educated in a diverse environment, because that's where that's the direction of this country. There are various projections showing the country will be majority-minority in some cases in the future. And so to prepare for that coming reality, both the business community and the academic community feel that it's important that you are exposed to some degree of diversity in your education, be it K-12 or higher education in particular.
Well, Ben Weider, thank you so much for getting us up to speed and getting us started today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He covers Education for Stateline. That's the news service of the Pew Center on the States. And we have a guest waiting in the wings. We'll be continuing our conversation, talking about this case before the U.S. Supreme Court involving affirmative action and taking another perspective on diversity. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Candlewick Press, publishers of John Klassen's new picture book, This Is Not My Hat, follow-up to the New York Times bestseller, I Want My Hat Back. This Is Not My Hat, available in bookstores and online retailers now.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Philadelphia Hospitality, a proud supporter of WHYY, is pleased to present Philadelphia Open House this weekend, October 12th through 14th. Philadelphia Open House features behind-the-scenes special access tours of more than 15 historical and cultural treasures along the Avenue of the Arts. A schedule of tours and tickets available online at philahospitality.org/openhouse or by phone at 215-790-9901, extension 11.
Tyler School of Art Alumni Association supports WHYY and hosts the Art Market at Tyler this Friday and Saturday. The Art Market at Tyler, a retail arts and crafts show, takes place on Temple's main campus. Details at alumni.temple.edu/Tyler.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear an affirmative action case tomorrow when Fisher v. the University of Texas at Austin is argued before the court. Abigail Fisher, who is white, claims she was denied admission to the university in 2008 because of her race. And joining us now is Richard Kallenberg. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes about education, equal opportunity, and civil rights. His new report, A Better Affirmative Action, State Universities That Created Alternative to Racial Preferences, was released last week. And Rick Kallenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And I know you were listening in as Ben was describing this case that's going to be argued tomorrow before the U.S. Supreme Court. What will you be looking for when this when it is argued?
Well, I'm going to be looking for whether the justices really push universities to create alternatives to racial preferences. So, you know, affirmative action is a hard issue. I think there are good arguments on both sides. We want our universities to be racially and ethnically diverse, or most people goodwill do at least. And at the same time, many of us are uneasy with the idea of counting race in deciding who gets ahead in society. And so the big question for the court, it seems to me, is whether it's possible to achieve both objectives, to get racial diversity, healthy levels of racial diversity at our leading universities without resorting to racial preferences. And I think the Supreme Court will really be pushing on that question.
In fact, that's what you have been writing about for some time now, saying it's time to look at this issue of, if not class, certainly socioeconomics, that should be perhaps a fairer determiner of who gets into college versus race.
Well, that's right. And you know, the research suggests that today being born poor and growing up in a neighborhood where everyone else around you is poor, those sorts of things are much more important in determining one's life chances than races per se. So there's one study which finds that the obstacles to doing well on the SAT are largely socioeconomic in nature. In fact, the socioeconomic obstacles are seven times as large as the racial obstacles. And so it seems to me that if we want to create a really fair system of admissions, one which looks at how well a student has done academically and in other areas in light of what obstacles she had to overcome, then we'd want to really focus on economic status rather than race.
But are you saying that race-based affirmative action has ended up helping off, what, well-off minorities or middle-class minorities and really hasn't helped people who are lower income?
Well, that's right. So there's one study by Derek Bach and William Bowen, who are supporters of affirmative action, who found that 86% of the African Americans at selective universities are middle class or upper class. Now the white students are even wealthier. But this is a big problem that higher education hasn't wanted to face up to. Right now, if you look at the most selective campuses, the 146 most selective campuses, basically you're 25 times as likely to run into a rich kid as a poor kid. And that is 74% of the students come from the richest quarter of the population, just 3% from the poorest. And so, you know, what affirmative action has been about is essentially creating an environment in which you have pretty wealthy kids of all colors. Now, in my view, that's better than, you know, wealthy kids of only
one color.
One or two colors. But it's not true diversity. If we want to really get at a diverse environment and to my mind, at least as important, a fair, kind of truly meritocratic admissions process, then you have to grapple with the enormous class divide in this country and open up doors for low-income students of all races.
But are you talking mostly about elite universities? Because it seems to me when you open it up to more public, you know, the more the universities where regular folks go to school, they probably are more diverse than, let's say, a Harvard.
Economically diverse.
Economically diverse.
I think that's certainly true. I mean, if you look at our community colleges, you have large numbers of low-income and working-class students. But the issue of affirmative action really kicks in at institutions which are selective, which have to decide who gets in. And in those places, we see very, very little economic diversity. And the study that I was citing before, looking at 146 institutions, you know, goes way beyond the Ivy League. It's including lots of public institutions that educate large numbers of students. And on the whole, these are not very economically diverse institutions.
But would you say, as Ben seemed to indicate earlier, that this is where our leadership largely comes from, these 146 universities?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's why people fight over this issue. There was one study that found that roughly half of our government leaders and business leaders in this country come from just 12 well-endowed, you know, wealthy institutions. So there's a lot at stake in this case.
I was reading about, this is two universities in California. Three state universities saw declines in minority enrollment after they ended affirmative action. They were Berkeley and UCLA in California and the University of Michigan. Are these outliers when it comes to what happens when universities get rid of affirmative action?
Yes. Our study, A Better Affirmative Action, looked at what happened in a number of states where, by voter initiative or executive order or legislation, affirmative action based on race was banned. To find out, well, what did universities do? Did they give up on racial diversity? And the answer was no. They began looking at alternatives. You know, the 10% plan that you were talking about earlier at Texas, the economic affirmative action programs that give a leg up to economically disadvantaged students of all races. And we found that in 7 of the 10 universities that we studied, the race-neutral alternatives produced as much racial and ethnic diversity, or even in some cases greater amounts of racial and ethnic diversity, as the use of race had in the past. The three outliers, as you mentioned, were Berkeley, UCLA, and the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And what's notable about those three is that they all draw on a fairly national pool of students. So there are lots of out-of-state students that go to these institutions. They're competing against other universities that have national pools. So to give you a concrete example of why it's really hard for Berkeley, UCLA, and University of Michigan to attract African-American and Latino students, if you're a highly talented African-American student who gets into Berkeley without a racial preference, because remember, Berkeley's banned from using preferences, you're probably also getting into Stanford, which can still provide a racial preference. And so that student is, you know, may very well end up not going to Berkeley, even though they got in. So looking at the results at those three institutions probably overstates the negative effect of a ban on racial preferences if it were imposed nationally by the Supreme Court, because right now Berkeley, UCLA, and the University of Michigan are playing on an unlevel field. They can't use racial preferences when most of the rest of the country still can.
And that's Richard Kallenberg. He's got a new report, just came out last week, titled A Better Affirmative Action, State Universities That Created Alternatives to Racial Preferences. We invited him to join us today in Radio Times because the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear a case tomorrow involving affirmative action. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, writes about education, equal opportunity, and civil rights. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY, is diversity a worthy goal, and what are the methods, what are the various paths to create diversity on college campuses? We'd love to hear from you. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. What about looking at the universities that you looked at that were able to create this diversity on campus? Did you find that poor whites were had a better leg up when it comes to things like income and socioeconomic factors?
Yes. So at the universities that were banned from using race, almost all of them switched to a system of class-based affirmative action, which will benefit low-income whites, low-income Asians, and interestingly, will benefit larger numbers of low-income African Americans and Latinos than current programs that are based on race do. Universities like to take obviously the highest scoring students that they can get, and because economic status imposes disadvantages on low-income applicants, they on average are going to be testing lower. Mm-hmm. So this opens the door for students who are from working class and low-income backgrounds. And our research at the Century Foundation over the years has suggested that many of these students can do quite well at the most selective institutions. And so One research study from Georgetown researchers found you could increase the proportion of students from the bottom economic half from 10% to 38% and still have graduation rates as high as they are today at the selective universities.
One of the things that you write about are that the universities that are partnering with local schools, local high schools, ensuring that those students get the kind of education that would qualify them for a college degree. How effective has that been?
Well, a number of states have adopted these programs. Our report didn't go into detail about whether individual programs have been able to raise the bar for students. But certainly the larger point, you wouldn't have any kind of affirmative action. You'd get equal opportunity right at the K-12 level. And that's part of what's encouraging about the states where race has been banned. They haven't been able to get by with simply kind of creaming off the very most advantaged students of color. They've had to reach into neighborhoods and schools that maybe never had sent people to the flagship university in the state and develop these partnerships. So to my mind, that's been a huge positive outcome. The good news is that universities didn't give up on racial diversity, and they're trying to, they're having to do kind of the hard work of really preparing students and helping prepare students as opposed to simply providing preferences based on race.
Because it gets to what I think most people agree is a serious problem in this country, which is the disparity in the quality of schools, whether it's grade schools, middle schools, or high schools, and there's such a disparity there. And as we know, certainly in a city like Philadelphia, there's a huge dropout rate. And I don't know whether colleges, universities are in the business of trying to fix all that, but they have to deal with the consequences of all that as well.
Well, that's right, and the bans on affirmative action have have forced universities to take more seriously their role in addressing inequalities at the K through 12 level. Mm-hmm. It's not the job of universities alone to address that issue, but they can be part of the solution, and they're definitely more motivated when they can't simply resort to racial preferences.
I mean, racism is not fixed. We still have discrimination in this country. In fact, a history of racial discrimination. Is there a history of class discrimination when it comes to college admissions?
Well, I would say that that both exist and continue to infect our society. Only a fool would suggest we've in any way conquered racism. But the way the Supreme Court looks at this is that the using a racial preference in university admissions is not the appropriate remedy for addressing societal discrimination. Going back to the 1970s, the Supreme Court has rejected that rationale. The idea is that instead we should clearly enforce civil rights laws where they exist, but also a class-based approach can try to indirectly address our history of discrimination, because there's a legacy there. So to give you one example, African Americans make about 60% of what whites make in terms of income, which is bad enough. But then African American wealth is only 5% of white wealth on average. That is, white families have 20 times the assets, net assets, that African American families have on average. Now, that's a reflection in large measure of our history of discrimination in this country. I mean, there is a legacy of slavery and segregation that is manifested in these enormous wealth inequalities that we have between blacks and whites. And the nice thing about the class-based approach is that it can implicitly address that history by giving a leg up to low wealth, students from low wealth families, as a matter of fairness, and that will disproportionately benefit groups that have been the subject of discrimination in this country.
And we're almost up on a break here, doesn't then a university or college still have to make a decision whether if a student comes from a family that makes $40,000 a year versus $50,000 a year, they still have to make a choice about a student based on a certain criteria?
Well, that's right. I mean, we will never be able to eliminate that issue, and these are tough decisions. But the idea here is that if a student has done well academically, despite the fact that she comes from a single parent family and the parent makes little money and the child went to mediocre schools, if they beat all those odds and did pretty well despite that, then there's something special there that we ought to reward.
Talking with Richard Kallenberg of the Century Foundation. He's got a new report just out called A Better Affirmative Action, State Universities That Created Alternatives to Racial Preferences. Our topic for today's Radio Times as the U.S. Supreme Court gets ready to hear a case involving affirmative action tomorrow. What do you think? How should we create diverse campuses? 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia supports WHYY and presents the film Not Much to Do, October 17th at 6 p.m. Made in 1966 by six African-American boys, Not Much to Do depicts the boys' quest for meaningful activities and the challenges of urban renewal in their West Philly neighborhood. A discussion by former project participants, including Oscar-nominated filmmaker Ben Actenberg, will follow. For tickets, history.pcusa.org or 215-928-3895.
Supporting WHYY, the Exit Zero International Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey, November 9th through 11th. The Cape May Convention Hall and eight club venues will feature jazz performances throughout the weekend, such as Ramsey Lewis and his electric band on Saturday, November 10th. Other festival highlights include wine tastings and Meet the Artist events. Congress Hall in Cape May is the official festival hotel. For tickets, reservations, and other festival details, ExitZeroJazzFest.com or 609-849-9202.
Supporting WHYY, Solbury School, a college preparatory day and boarding school for 7th through 12th grade. Located in New Hope, Pennsylvania, Solbury School offers a 1-to-6 teacher-to-student ratio and is committed to intellectual challenge and academic achievement, creative and independent thinking, and respect for individuality and diversity. Their open house is Sunday, October 21st from 1 to 4 p.m. Details at 215-862-5261 or solbury.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This news just in, Jerry Sandusky was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in a Philadelphia, or I should say in a Pennsylvania courtroom today. We will be talking more about that tomorrow in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about another path to diversity on campuses that doesn't involve race-based admissions. And again, Richard Kallenberg is our guest. We have a full bank of calls. Rick, let's get some callers in. We have Brian from Gloucester joining us on Radio Times. Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a community college professor, so we see a lot of this activity at our college.
Sure.
And it is very difficult. I will say, speaking from the academic side of the process as opposed to admissions, it's a very difficult thing for us. It's a very difficult question because we have students who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, even when they do well, often have trouble with the academic curriculum that their more economically advantaged counterparts have.
And that's just because of their preparation, perhaps their life experience, the kinds of tools and skills that they have brought to the community college, Brian?
Yeah, and that's what we find is we have a very difficult time because it's not a question of aptitude, it's not a question of willingness to work. It's that often these come coupled with a background of secondary school and high school that was not as advantageous. They don't have exposure to the type of topics or research methods or other things that students at more economically advantaged schools have. So we have this problem of we have these really bright students who come into our community college program because it's affordable, because it's inclusive, and they're still just not as prepared. And we have a really hard time trying to figure out what to do because we don't want to lower academic standards, but at the same time we find that these students, for lack of a better term, the damage is often already done with them, as I have to say,
by
the time they get to college.
I hear you, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Richard Kallenberg a chance to respond. What do you think, Rick?
Well, I think Brian raises an important point. I spend a lot of time writing about K-12 education as well as higher education, and one of the biggest issues that we face in this country is growing economic segregation in our schools. There's research to suggest that a low-income student who's given a chance to go to a middle-class school is 2 years ahead of a low-income student who's stuck in a high-poverty school by the fourth grade. This is on the National Assessment for Educational Progress in Math. So trying to find ways to give more students a chance to go to economically integrated schools, I think, could have an enormous impact. This has to be done through public school choice, not through compulsory busing. I mean, that didn't work very well, but there are a lot of interesting programs out there in Hartford, St. Louis, and other places where low-income students, if given a chance to go to a middle-class public school, will perform at much higher levels, and then she'll be prepared to go on to college.
And Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Rick, I heard Brian say these are smart kids. These are smart students. It's not about intelligence. It's about skill level.
Absolutely. And that's why that's what's such a tragedy is that we, as a society, are wasting so much talent because there are lots of naturally talented, low-income, and working-class students who simply aren't receiving an adequate education at the K-12 level, and we need to deal with it there and at the pre-K level as well.
Let me see what Sean from Olney has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead, Sean.
Sure. I wanted to talk just about the social capital aspect of this conversation. I think affirmative action and its racial focus is important and necessary, and I think what colleges need to do more of is A, teach better whatever skill level students are coming in with, but also help the students understand their role as people integrating and their role as people acquiring skills that they're going to use when they get out in the workplace. And I'm just thinking about what he just said about increasing wealth,
right,
and historically minorities not having the wealth as the majority population. If you attack affirmative action on the racial grounds just to effect change on the economic grounds, you're doing some bad damage to the history that's been made, to the progress that's been made. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay, fair enough, Sean. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Richard Kallenberg, any response?
Well, I think Sean makes a good point, and one question we haven't talked about is why not do both? Why not do affirmative action based on race and based on class? And to me, that's a difficult issue. It's one I've struggled with for a number of years, but my reading of the way universities work is that they say that they're doing both right now. They say, well, we pay attention to economic disadvantage and to race, but the research suggests that they don't, that they provide fairly large preferences based on race on the order of 300 SAT points for African-American students, and almost nothing to provide a leg up or preference to low-income and working-class students. Now, the exception to that rule is the universities that are banned from using race. So for complicated reasons, university officials care about racial diversity. They perhaps because it's more visible than economic diversity. And so they will strive to get that racial diversity. When they are banned from using race, they put an increasing emphasis on economic status as an indirect way of getting racial diversity. So it's not that they suddenly care about economic diversity. It's that if you want to get racial diversity, you now have to take this more indirect route of looking at class. So if we want universities to address the class question, allowing them to use racial preferences actually complicates things, because they will simply take the easy way out. They'll do what Stephen Carter at Yale Law School calls racial justice on the cheap. They'll admit the most advantaged students of color. And I think we need to really be addressing these larger economic issues that are deeply connected with race in our country.
But it sounds like you are saying that if you use economics as or low income or income as a determining factor, you end up with racial diversity.
Absolutely. So particularly if you define economic status in a sophisticated way that recognizes that in this country, black poverty is different than white poverty. It's different in part because, as I mentioned, there's the wealth issue and accumulation of assets over time, but there's also the issue of neighborhood concentrations of poverty and school concentrations of poverty. It turns out that poor whites are more likely to live in middle-class neighborhoods than middle-class African-Americans. Now, that has to do with our racial segregation in our neighborhoods and in our schools. But a class-based affirmative action that looks at not only income, but also concentrations of poverty, whether you are a student is growing up in a neighborhood where everyone else is poor or large numbers of others are poor, that will disproportionately benefit students of color.
Is it time to get rid of legacy preferences, alumni preferences?
I think so. I edited a book that the Century Foundation published a couple of years ago on legacy preferences called Affirmative Action for the Rich. And the notion was, here are these preferences that go to the children of alumni who are disproportionately white,
disproportionately wealthy, these are the kids who are least deserving of a leg up. I mean, they've had all the advantages for the most part. It's very hard to justify those. And one of the interesting findings in our study was that of the 10 universities we looked at where they were banned from using race, three of them also dropped legacy preferences. So they were, you know, given that they weren't using race, it was, you know, correctly seen as hypocritical to continue to give a preference to the children of alumni. So I think we ought to go after legacy preferences, and I think, quite frankly, this is part of why higher education is so strongly supportive of racial preferences. You know, part of it is genuine. I have no doubt that they are concerned about racial diversity. But part of it is that if racial preferences fall, then legacy preferences may fall. And that's something that wealthy right. universities are worried about.
Well, because they oftentimes get donations from those very happy alumni when their children get in.
Although if I can just say quickly,
yeah,
the research on that is very mixed, actually. We included in our study a question, you know, do universities with legacy preferences actually bring in more money when you control for appropriate factors? And the answer was no. And part of it is that universities are becoming so selective that they end up angering a lot of alumni by rejecting their children, and then donations fall off a cliff. So it's a complicated question.
I was going to say, we live in a very complicated world. Let me get Tracy from Yardley to join our conversation. And Tracy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank
hi there.
You.
You're welcome.
Great conversation.
Thank
and
you.
I guess from the perspective of, you know, we've clearly talked about there's plenty of evidence to show that, you know, increasing the opportunities for children to move from low income to middle income areas is, you know, creating success in schools.
Sure.
And I wonder if universities typically get involved with creating, you know, a program like that wherever they're located. I'm thinking of a really successful program in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, the Fair Share Housing Development Corporation, which has done a great job of taking children from low-income Camden schools, you know, helping place them through affordable housing into Mount Laurel schools. And they have a great study just out recently. I don't know who did the study, but to show that the students are, you know, highly successful. The entire family growth has increased. And I just wonder if there's an opportunity for universities to help programs like this that hopefully eventually will eliminate the need for affirmative action.
Well, Tracy, that's an interesting point. It really dovetails, Rick Kallenberg, to what you were saying earlier about helping kids and moving them into more middle-class schools.
Well, that's right. And housing is ultimately an important part of this discussion. So we published a study at the Century Foundation in 2010, which looked at Montgomery County, Maryland public schools right outside of Washington, D.C. And there were low-income housing students who were randomly assigned to units throughout the county. And the question was, where do students do better, low-income students? Do they do better in a school where there are high poverty concentrations, but they spend extra money per pupil for reduced class size and better professional development of teachers, extended learning time? Or do students do better in middle-class schools where they get a little less spent on them in Montgomery County, Maryland? And the results were unmistakable. The students who had a chance to go to live in middle-class neighborhoods and to go to middle-class schools performed quite a bit better than those who were stuck in the high-poverty schools. And I'd like to see universities become more involved in this issue.
That's interesting. Let me get, looks like Kristen from Valley Forge to join us on Radio Times. And Kristen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was calling because I actually just graduated from a liberal arts college, and I found that the students who were at the college who were mostly receiving financial aid and therefore diversity felt extremely entitled and felt that they should get everything and have all the opportunities, and they were actually, in fact, given those opportunities. And I found it interesting what your guest just said about legacies, because I was actually a third-generation student, and it meant nothing. It was like no one in my family had ever gone to the college. So it's very interesting for me to see how I was treated, and then for my mother and grandmother to sort of look at it from the outside in. So that's just my comment.
Well, it's an interesting comment. Kristen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rick Kallenberg, any response from you?
Well, I think that, one of the interesting questions about the legacy preference issue is whether people feel, in any sense, guilty about getting in with a bump up for the children of alumni. And, there are all sorts of issues that are raised about the stigma associated with affirmative action, either based on class or race. But I'm wondering why there isn't more of that associated with legacy preference.
Interesting. So what will you be, this case before the U.S. Supreme Court, do you see this as, no matter how the court rules, as a significant case in terms of our understanding of and even support for things like affirmative action?
Yes, I think this is going to be a pivotal case. Affirmative action has survived kind of by the skin of its teeth on number of different levels. Back in 78, people thought it might go down. In 2003, but this may be the case where the Supreme Court finally says it's time to try something different, to move beyond race. And the effect of that will be that universities will likely take on this bigger issue of class. And this is an idea that has very noble origins. If you go back to Martin Luther King's book, Why We Can't Wait, he says, we need to deal with our history of discrimination in this country. But rather than proposing a Bill of Rights for African Americans, he said, we need a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged. And I'm hoping that will come out of this U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Well, we have to end on that note. Richard Kallenberg, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it, Marty.
No problem, and our pleasure. And he's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a new report called A Better Affirmative Action, State Universities That Created Alternatives to Racial Preferences, just released last week. Stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.